Actually approached the table at one point.
Pension Commission will come to order. Senator Foley, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to, the MSRS bills, we cannot start until after 9 o'clock. The executive director cannot be here till 9. So if you're an MSRS bill, you can go have coffee, relax, come back at 9. 9 or so. We're going to do the Foley-Hortman bill first, and then we're going to do number 9, Fritz bill. Senator Foley, Representative Hortman. Why don't we have, this is Ed, give us a brief review. Morning, Dick.
Members, the issue here involves a St. Paul firefighter who was hired as a St. Paul firefighter during 1980. And depending when the individual was hired, the individual would have been appropriately placed in either the local relief association or parapolice and fire, because there was some legislation in 1980 that declared that individuals hired after a certain date would become members of the statewide plan. In my view, the central issue for the commission to decide on this is whether the city and para are using a reasonable definition of first employment date. The city and PERA apparently agrees with the city on this interpretation. The city is using as the first employment date the date on which the city told this firefighter that you are hired, and that happened to be June 13th, 1980. If that's the first employment date, then the individual was appropriately placed in the local plan. If not, if the first hire date is the date that the individual first went to work as a firefighter, then there's an argument that the person should have been placed in parapolice and fire. What the individual is asking for is a benefit from the parapolice and fire plan. That would be very unusual in that the individual was placed in the local plan, given on the city's interpretation of first employment date. So the individual is asking for a benefit from a plan in which the individual was never a member. And there are some issues about if PERA was to pay a benefit to this individual, who would cover the cost of that, since PERA never received any assets from the city on behalf of this individual. So there are some amendments to deal with any issues you have there. With those few comments, I'll turn it back to the commission.
Okay. Representative Hortman.
Good morning. My name is Melissa Hortman. I'm a state representative for Clyde Thomas. And I think that there are a few important additions to the facts as Mr. Burke has presented them. Mr. Thomas started working as a St. Paul firefighter on June 30th, 1980. The first day he showed up to work, when he was filling out all his paperwork, his employer told him to backdate the portion pertaining to pensions to have the date that he started be June 14th. There was a group of recruits. I can only surmise that maybe the firefighters who were then on duty weren't happy about the switch to para, and they wanted as many people in their plan as long as possible. But Mr. Thomas started working as a firefighter on June 30th, 1980. Under the statute in effect at that time, Section 423A, I think it's .01, it states that all firefighters employed after June 15th were to be in para. That was a statutory mandate. And so under the statutory mandate, he should have been placed in para. As it was, he worked as a St. Paul firefighter for 10 years, paid into the St. Paul Firefighter Relief Association, and then that association merged later with para. So it's not as exactly as though he's requesting money from a plan that he didn't pay into. All the contributions that Mr. Thomas made to the plan are now in para, the entity that he's asking for relief from. I think it's the most important thing to focus on is your first day of work when you show up and you're filling out paperwork. If your employer tells you what you're supposed to put on your paperwork, are you supposed to have the presence of mind to understand that what they're telling you is not right? and to know the consequences and to tell your employer on your first day of work, no, I'm not going to do what you're asking me to do. We all know that when we get a job offer, that we don't start working until we show up on the first day of work. I think it's really important to look at the first employed date that we use in our day-to-day lives and to look at Mr. Thomas's situation of what would be fair given that he paid into the plan for 10 years and during that time there were no Social Security deductions taken from his paycheck. I don't know if Mr. Thomas or Mary, if you could introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Mary Browning. I'm the director of the Upper Midwest Pension Rights Project of the Minnesota Senior Federation. We've spent quite a bit of time looking at the facts in this case, and I would like to point out a few more facts. One is that when we researched what this issue meant, first date of hire versus the day that you actually begin work, we received a lot of conflicting information. It appears as if it had been the practice in the city of St. Paul that those dates were intermingled over time depending on what the requirements were of the specific situation. The second thing I'd like to point out is the bylaws of the Relief Association at the time stated that you became a member of the St. Paul Fire Relief Association upon the day that you are entered into the payroll and that you take the oath. The oath, it's been also difficult to discern exactly going back 20 years or 25 years when the oath was taken by these men, but it clearly was not the day that they were told they had a job. They were all given the oath together, so it could not have taken place until after June 15th. And I believe it probably took place, to the best of anyone's recollection, on June 30th, the first day that they started their training. Another point that I would like to make is if this was a ministerial practice at the time, that in itself of backdating the Relief Association application was not necessarily in error. If it had to do with some conflicting administrative practices in St. Paul at the time and that was the best solution, that in itself is not the problem. But when you combine it with the fact that the legislature had decreed that anyone hired after June 15th was to go into PARA, then at that point in time, those who were making the decision, I believe, made a fiduciary error in playing roulette with these particular young men's retirement benefits. They had the discretionary ability to make a choice. They were clearly put on notice that no one else was to be put into the Relief Association, and they chose to backdate it. In that context, we believe it was clearly in error and a fiduciary breach.
Okay. Thank you. PERA. St. Paul and PERA, could you join us? Please. Thank you. Why don't we hear from St. Paul first?
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm Terry Haltner with the City of St. Paul. Clearly, this situation occurred a long time ago, so I had to do quite a bit of research myself. To the best of my knowledge, what I can tell from the situation is when we hire firefighters, we hire them all in a class. There's a number of reasons for doing that, but basically we bring them all on at the same date so they have the same seniority date. That affects bidding on jobs. It affects bidding on vacation. Because of the rotating shifts, if we used a higher date of the date they actually started work, where they fell in the pecking order would depend on which shift they were placed on. So it's been the practice forever to hire them in classes. To the best of my knowledge, that's why everybody went in with the same date. Again, it was a long time ago, and it was a little difficult to research back. But
Did somebody start on the 14th or no in that class?
I'm not sure on the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Thomas?
Oh, sir, no one started on the 14th. Everybody started on the 15th of June. I'm sorry, the 30th of June.
So nobody in the class had a shift prior to the 30th?
No.
As you understand, as you
recall.
Everyone
reported on the 30th of June, and the only paper we filled out, W-2s, all the paperwork we filled out, we dated June 30th. The only piece of paper that we dated June 14th or the 13th was the admission to the Relief Association.
I can tell you that when we go into our payroll records and the records that we have, everything says the 13th for hire date. It does not have the 30th on the hire date in our system.
Okay, questions for St. Paul? Representative Wardlow?
Do you have I know in the military there's a pay entry base date, which may be different than your enlistment date, so your time of service and your length of service is based on maybe a longer period of time than your pay entry base date is, or vice versa. And I'm wondering if you have a situation like that in your organization.
They would use the hire date of the 13th for looking at seniority issues. I will say if people are off for extended period of times, the service would be adjusted for that, but basically the 13th would have been used for all seniority issues with the city over their entire career.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm just curious why all of them were backdated to the 13th or 14th if they all showed up on the 30th, and that confuses me.
And I have to say, the people that would have been involved in that hiring aren't with the city anymore. So when I look at the records, all I can tell is that basically all the dates for those people, it was the 13th, and that was used for seniority. It was the practice, again, for years and years that they all hired on the same class. I don't know why the 13th was picked.
Mr. Chair?
Chair, I'm having a hard time hearing you, first of all. But secondly, what is on all the records of those employees in that class, what was their date of hire?
We show a date of hire of June 13th.
June 13th for everyone?
Yes.
And so all the raises or increments that people went based upon seniority was all triggered off the 13th of June?
Correct.
So it wasn't just the one document?
It wasn't. In our system, in our computer system, it shows 13th as the hire date for all those individuals.
Excuse me. Can you point something out?
Pardon me one second.
Okay.
Can St. Paul provide us some documentation on that?
Senator Pogemiller, I'm sorry, this is Melissa Hartman again. I just want to point out one of the pages in your packet that's called Employment Service History. It's about the fifth page of the packet that Ed has put together. Maybe it's the seventh page. It's a printout of the employment history at the St. Paul Fire Department, and it indicates June 13th certified appointment, June 30th employment. I think that really kind of sums up the point that I'm trying to make, is that there's a difference between the date you get hired and the date that you're first employed. And under the statute, the date that Mr. Thomas was first employed is the relevant date. So when you look at the second line, and it indicates that employment commenced on June 30th, 1980, it seems to me that disposes of the issue.
I'm not seeing on here. Yeah, I see that. I see. Okay. Is that what St. Paul's? Is that what St. Paul's? Is that the 30th date you're talking? And the 13th date you're talking about? Or are you talking about a different 13th date, a payroll date?
No, the payroll date is different. But you know, like I said, in our system, we're showing what raises and seniority would key off of would be the appointment date.
Well, were there other than these? Was it 14 people? Was it 14 that were hired at this time? Are there other than that 14 hired in this general? Time period?
No, that would be the entire class.
Okay.
Yeah.
So whatever we do with Mr. Thomas's situation, we should do for all 14, presumably, correct?
Well, yeah, I think I don't know if there's anybody else in his specific situation where it would affect the benefit because of the subsequent merger into para.
As far as we know, there was no one else who left the department. I mean, we're talking about a time frame of about 2 months. Had Mr. Thomas stayed another 2 months, then the St. Paul police would have adopted the ordinance that the legislature had passed regarding the five-year vesting rule, and he had 10 years in. So it was an unfortunate set of circumstances where he missed that. I just wanted to make sure that everyone understood that that Mr. Thomas and his coworkers did not start to get paid until after the work that they did on the beginning on the 30th.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you said employment date, are you talking, you just said everything was triggered off employment date. Are you talking about the employment date listed here, which is the 30th or the 13th?
I'm sorry, it would be the appointment date. And I have to say, practices have changed a couple times over the last 25 years.
Can I ask a question of Ms. Mary Vanek?
She's going to be next. Anything else for St. Paul right now? Okay, Ms. Vanek, thank you.
Chair and members, I'm Mary Vanek, the director of PERA. We were contacted to research this case. I spoke to a former board member of the St. Paul Fire Relief Association who produced for me a record that indicated that the appointment date was, in fact, June 13th. And then I went to the city and asked them how they interpreted this. And they felt that it was interpreted correctly, that he was actually certified for appointment to the position prior to the change to para PNF coverage. He wasn't enrolled into the Relief Association until he was actually paid and a deduction could be taken from his wages. So we really default to the City of St. Paul primarily for the reason that there's no money in the fund to pay a benefit. When he left and there was no right to a benefit and the Relief Association bylaws did not provide for a refund, those particular assets diverted to the fund and offset the ongoing employer cost. So if, in fact, it is deemed that he is owed a benefit, whether it's based on Relief Association bylaws or para PNF, the bill, as staff is drafted, is absolutely right on. We need to collect money from somebody, and apparently the City of St. Paul, because they gained from those contributions reverting to the assets of the fund.
How much do we know? Do we have a number?
The value of the benefit, were he to be granted a Relief Association benefit, would be roughly $801 a month. And the amount that we would transfer to the post fund to fund that for his lifetime would be $145,515. If he were granted police and fire credit for that service, the monthly benefit would be valued at roughly $1,029 a month. And the amount to be transferred to the post-retirement fund would be roughly $166,300.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, I don't know if this is even going to make sense, but say he had been hired 6 months later, what date was Tara using is for qualifying to prepare a PNF at that point. Does that make sense? Is it the certified date or the employment date?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, we rely on the employer to give us the hire date. And oftentimes, the hire date and the enrollment into the plan date are identical, but as you will hear in other cases today, that sometimes isn't the case. And there are typically reasons for that, primarily that the individual may not have earned enough to qualify for coverage immediately. That is generally not the case in police and fire. Their hire date and their enrollment into the plan date are typically identical, and we would have used anyone with a hire date of June 16, 1980 forward as being required to pay and declare a police and fire under the law.
Chair, but you would just rely on the City of St. Paul to tell you what that date was?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes.
Further questions? Representative Osment.
Yes, I'm curious with regard to, well, I guess I have a question really for Mr. Thomas rather than PRE. Let me go ahead with that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Thomas, when you were appointed, was that appointment sent to you in the mail, or how were you notified of the appointment? Did you actually show up? Or?
Yes, we were notified through the mail. After you go on a list as far as the recruits, and then they how many they're going to put in the class, they'll notify the 14 people. And during that month, you'll take a physical, a psychological exam, and you do all these things before your reporting date. And so we were notified in the mail that our reporting date would be the 30th of June.
Is this the total exposure?
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, Mr. Thomas, you were the notice of appointment was just a written notice that you had been appointed. It's kind of like when I get elected, I know I'm going to take office if I live long enough at the first of the year, but I'm really not a state representative until I'm actually sworn in on that date. So the date that you were actually showed up to be sworn in was the 30th. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you received no pay, no benefits, nor the city had no obligation between the 13th and the 30th to you. Is
that's
that correct?
Correct. And
why they be using some other date besides the 30th is beyond me. That's it seems to me that you're that post-dating really did, I don't know what the motivation was, but it sure did goof things up for you. I'm a retired Minneapolis firefighter, so I know exactly the process you went through, and that's why the appointment date is something significantly different than the date that I actually showed up and got sworn in. I just got a piece of paper in the mail telling me to show up on a specific date, and that's the date that everything triggered off of. Not the date I was appointed or received notice.
Ms. Vanek, is PERA agnostic on this if you're made whole financially?
Mr. Chair.
Or are there other issues from your perspective?
Generally, the board doesn't oppose if it full actuarial value if it's deemed it should have been eligible service. My concern, however, is how many others may have been enrolled in relief associations. Now, typically, I believe that you can go back and look at the majority of the active members who came into PERA under consolidation, chose police and fire benefits, and got credit at our benefit levels. But are there any folks who have retired under relief association benefits who may have been on that borderline and may come back and be concerned about whether or not they were appropriately enrolled? It opens the door for others to challenge whether or not they should have been enrolled in the relief plan. And if there are others out there who were in the relief plan, didn't vest, and are now gone off somewhere else, if they come to the table, we don't know who they are or where they would be or if there are any. So it raises an open the door policy issue for us.
Representative Murphy.
I have a question, Mr. Burke. Have we had previous bills that related to this topic and this problem?
Members of the commission, no, I cannot recall any bills where we had this type of hire date issue where it determined whether you went into a local plan or the statewide plan. This has not come up before.
And Mr. Chair, I have a question, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Thomas, this happened in June
1980. Yes, ma'am.
Why are we first hearing about it then in January, February of 2006?
Ma'am, I took other action. I went to court, me and three other firefighters, to receive a refund from Relief Association. And what the attorney didn't bring out was he put us all in a class action. And the other two didn't have the same situation as I had. They were hired in 1970. Up under the Relief Association. They weren't backdated or anything. And so the judgment came down with all three of us. And my particular case wasn't brought out of the back signing and things like that. Another point is when PARA and the Relief Association joined, each person had a choice to choose which pension fund they wanted to go in. So Ms. Vanek says, someone might come and say that we felt that we were owed more money. That each person had a choice whether they wanted to continue with the Relief Association or PARA's program. So those who were in the Relief Association had a choice.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thomas, when was the court case?
That was in 1993, ma'am. And
so, Mr. Thomas, why wasn't this brought to our attention then in 1994, or 5, or 6, or between then and now?
Well, ma'am, I didn't know, after the case in court, I didn't know which steps to take. And so just through the years talking to different people, I finally start talking to individuals. They would tell me to talk to someone else, and I finally reached Ms. Browning. But I didn't know which action to take because I had was turned down in the court, right? And so I didn't know where to go from there. And so finally, by just trying to research things, I finally wind up talking to Ms. Browning, and this is where we're here today.
And Mr. Chair, I would just like to mention, Mr. Thomas, this is a usual question that I ask when people, I realize that people sometimes don't know what they're going to do until they talked with their counselor on retirement. When, in fact, they should have done something 20 years ahead of time. But I always like to bring to their attention, too, that there were a lot of years there where they were just sitting. When injustice, between the time that supposedly and the injustice had been done and now, and that's a lot of years that we could have used to make up some of that money.
I understand, ma'am, but I didn't know where to go or what to do until I did.
Add something to that. when we were researching this situation, we discovered that in the process of the court case, Mr. O'Neill, who was representing the police and fire department at the time, or the Relief Association at the time, or the city of St. Paul, I'm not sure which, sent essentially a memo to Mr. Thomas's attorney pointing out the statute that does allow currently for 5-year vesting for members of a relief association. So at the time, Mr. Thomas did receive this information that he might eventually vest when it came time for retirement, because he did have his 5 years in. What he was missing, that piece of knowledge that the city of St. Paul had to adopt that resolution in order to get that 5-year vesting to go, which is what they did. They actually, I believe they voted for it before Mr. Thomas left his position, but it had to be ratified by the city council. So that happened some 30 days after Mr. Thomas left. So there was also some confusion as to whether he was eligible for 5-year vest under the 5-year vesting rule.
Just a closing comment I want to make, because there's a lot of lawyers up there, and when I hear that something has been in the courts already, then to me the person's had a hearing and, you know, maybe the case has been decided. But I think it's very important to point out that this particular issue that I'm and Mr. Thomas are bringing to the commission today was not addressed in the court. That was a different issue about whether he was entitled to a refund. And so the issue that we're asking for your help on has not been litigated and decided by the courts.
Senator Betzel.
Just a quick observation, Mr. Chair. The we seem to be at odds here. The city seems to, as the start date, Representative Hortman pointed out the service history, and it, apparently the appointment date was June 13th. It says employment date was June 30th, and, of course, there's been arguments on both sides. I went back and looked at the statute. The language says that all persons first employed, we use the word employed, by any municipal police officer after June 15th, 1980. I think if the word had been appointed, that would have led it one way. But we use the word employed. So there must have been an intention when this statute was written that person actually start work, which kind of ties into what Representative Osmond was saying.
St. Paul, thank you. I think... Does the city have anything to add here? Because I think the way this looks, it's headed, is that PERE is going to be made whole, and St. Paul's going to pay for it. But, you know, I'm not saying, I'm not predisposing what the commission is going to do, but I'm just kind of listening. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to give an opportunity for St. Paul to maybe add something that we haven't thought of here. It seems to me that's the direction this is headed.
I guess all that I would add is in looking back and my research, it appears to me that the process that was followed with this class was the same process the city had followed when they appointed other classes before and after the changeover from the Relief Association to PERA. nothing unique was done in this situation.
Why don't we, Representative Osmond moves that tentatively, Senate File 2104, 2311 be recommended for incorporation, including the 242 technical amendment, and pay the annuity, which, Representative Odman, have you had a chance? Perhaps we can, we'll have some discussions with St. Paul and PERA to kind of decide which level of payment is most appropriate.
I'll move the technical amendment to get before us.
Yeah, the technical amendment is part of the motion. This is a tentative incorporation with the technical amendment, with further discussions with St. Paul and PERA as to what would be the appropriate level of benefit. Is that your motion?
Yes.
Okay, and we will come back officially on this. But I think we do need to do a little further look at this to kind of make sure there's not something we're missing here. And St. Paul, knowing that they may have to pay for this now, may want to go back and do a little further research to find out if there's something we're not missing. And Ms. Vanek will probably be talking to us about, too, if she discovers that there are 500 people out there that are coming in next week. We want to think about that also. So this is tentative, Mr. Thomas. I don't think the commission's finally decided, but I think it's headed perhaps in a direction that you would like, but I'm not sure we're quite there yet. Is that comfortable for the commission? Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, I'm not sure what tentative inclusion means.
Well, we're going to have it on the suspension bill. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's going to incorporate all of these individual bills.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, do we then, if we don't like the idea at that time, then we have to move to delete?
No, we'll be a little more flexible than that. No, we're going to do these individual bills on consensus basis the best we can.
Okay.
If there's something that a member or a couple members of the commission just are adamant about, you know, it's unlikely we're going to pick up on this bill.
So, Mr. Chair, when City of St. Paul and Ms. Vanek and PERA get together and maybe come up with a plan or come up with an amount, and are we going to put them back on the agenda? Or do we just do
depends
that?
Depends how adamant everybody's about it. If it looks like we've got a consensus, we're going to go with it. We're looking at $145,000 or $166,000, it appears, one or the other. Okay, on the Osment motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion's adopted. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. And again, this is tentative at this point.
Thank you.
We need to do some further work, okay? Thank you very much, sir. Okay, Representative Fritz, and then we'll take Senator Day's bill after that.
But it's more than that. No,
this is number 9, I believe, members. Oh, number 9. We're talking number 9 right now. Mr. Burke.
Members, this one should be a fairly straightforward issue. This involves a Faribault firefighter who was a member of is a member of Parapolice and Fire. And apparently there were a few months at the very beginning of his career for which he does not have Parapolice and Fire coverage, and it appears to be because the city failed to alert PARA that the individual should be a member. The materials suggest that the city acknowledges its error in this situation and is willing to do whatever is necessary in order to make the individual whole.
Hey, PRA, does that sound about right? Mary, are you with us? Is that accurate? The city acknowledges its error and...
Mr. Chair, members, yes. We have verification from the city that they could see no reason why he shouldn't have been enrolled for those 4 months.
Okay, and is there money involved here?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Much.
We have determined that the actuarial cost of the additional 4 months is $5,253. The employee obligation of contributions plus interest would be $2,998. And if the city is only to pay the difference between those two, the city's obligation is $2,255. However, just another piece of information, we did calculate what the employer contributions would have been for those 4 months and put the interest on there, and that value is $4,496. So the law, the actuarial purchase service law, anticipates we calculate the value. The employee pays at least contributions plus interest, and the employer pays the difference. But in this case, the employer contributions that would have been paid actually is greater than that difference. So I would defer to staff. I mean, we very rarely run into this kind of outcome. So.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the full actuarial value service credit purchase provision was revised last year, so that if contributions plus interest is greater than the full actuarial value, we would go with the contributions plus interest. So I believe the situation is handled within the statute, and the city would pay the higher amount that Ms. Vanek indicated, the $4,496.
Okay, so the motion for the bill with 250 with the 253 amendment gets us to where we need to go, which is the First Amendment.
I believe so.
Okay, Senator Representative Thiessen, are you moving that?
Sure.
Representative Thiessen's moving House File 2219, Senate File 2141 with the 253 amendment.
Let Fritz say something.
Representative Fritz, do you have the need to say something?
Well, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing this today, and I want also to introduce one of Faribault's finest, Captain Todd Rost, who did take off from duty this morning to be here just in case you had any questions for him.
Captain, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing us out this morning. Do you have any questions for me? Just what happened?
I think we're in good shape.
Okay. They just never retroed me back to the start date. They put you on probation for 6 months, and they just never retroed me back to my start date. That's all that happened here. So,
okay. On the Thiessen motion for incorporation, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Appreciate it. Senator Day? And then we'll take Senator Day's is number 6. And then we're going to take, I believe, number 7. Senator Day?
Mr. Chairman, the last presenter had such a good time not saying anything, I thought we'd just kind of be quiet here this morning. Tim Biegert is with me, and I think he can explain the situation actually better than myself. So, Mr. Chairman and members, thanks for just hearing this.
One sec. Larry, give us a brief review. Ed?
Members, what this bill would do is allow the individual to purchase approximately 10 years of teaching service that the individual had in Montana. Some of the issues that arise with this is that there's no clear pension problem to be solved here in that the individual was a vested member of the teacher's retirement plan in Montana. So since the individual was covered for that service, it's not clear why the individual really needs this bill. I also mentioned cost. It could be quite expensive, and it's quite possible the individual doesn't understand the full cost of that, because the individual seems to be familiar with the Montana system. The Montana system has some provisions that allow individuals to purchase service credit on a highly subsidized basis. That's not the case in Minnesota, so the cost could be very high. And there are some precedent concerns here in that this could lead the commission back to recommending a general law provision to allow out-of-state teaching service to be covered by teacher plans. Since we allowed that to expire a few years ago, I don't know if you want to go back in that direction. With those comments, I'll turn it back to the chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I moved back to Minnesota to help take care of my mother, who's getting older. And when I was researching moving back to Minnesota, I saw that there was a vehicle for transferring your teacher's retirement. Because I started teaching in Minnesota in 2002. And at that time, there was a vehicle to transfer your teacher's retirement to Minnesota. I wasn't aware that I had to be vested prior to transferring that service time. I am vested now in Minnesota. But when the vehicle expired, I was invested. I was in my second year, and you need to have 3 years to be vested. But I am willing to, the money is in the Montana Teachers Retirement, and I'm willing to transfer that over. And it's important to me to have those 10 years transferred over, and I would pay the amount that was above and beyond what is in the Montana account. I'm not aware of how much it is, though. I'll have to find out.
TRA? Mr. Luther?
Good morning, Chairman, Commission. My name is Luther Thompson, representing TRA. The current cost for 10 years is $57,385. That's for 10 years of service. He has 11.2 years of service at Montana. Mr. Burek pointed out, he is fully vested already, has a pension plan there. So I think it's a choice between the calculation, how much would he be losing, what happens to that additional 1.2 years he has out there, and whether it's in his best interest, because they are two different plans. Clearly, before the law was repealed, he would have still had to take a refund and terminate his membership in that plan out there. And this is based upon the full actuarial method. There would be no harm to TRA, but the present value is $57,385. That's assuming a retirement date. I think it's in the year 2025, when he's age 66. He's a post-89 teacher, so the rule of 90 doesn't apply to him.
Questions? So, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson, if Mr. Is it Biegert? Biegert?
You're correct, sir, Mr. Biegert.
If Mr. Biegert is able to take the money out of the Montana plan and have it transferred into TRA, and if he's willing to make up the difference, does TRA have any opposition to that, which I believe is what Mr. Biegert said he was willing to do?
No, we wouldn't have any opposition to that, but all of the previous prior service out of teaching purchases required that the teacher was no longer entitled to receive an annuity, you know, a current or deferred annuity in that plan for those years he was purchasing. I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. He's got, like I said, he's got 11.1 years. I don't know exactly how it all works out in Montana. If he takes, he has to take a refund for the, you know, the entire period of time, and what that amounts to. We simply don't know what the Montana plan provides. But we need, we would need $57,385 at TRE. I think the broader issue is all of these, you know, purchase of out-of-state teaching for teachers and the whole portability issue, and I think that would be an excellent issue to take up at a later time and discuss it a little more extensively.
Mr. Thompson, are you saying that once all these numbers are worked, Mr. Biegert may want to think otherwise, or you're not certain about that?
I'm not certain, but you know, I've looked at Mr. Biegert's memo, and there certainly seems to be some advantages in the Montana plan. I believe he's entitled to a retirement annuity at age 60 out there, which is going to be at least 6 years earlier than it would be in Minnesota. So that's a financial issue he would have to address. That's one issue. I mean, I don't know what's in his best interest, but in the best interest of TRA, we need 57.
No, we understand that. You said that four times now, I think. I think we got that point. Members, what are you thinking here?
Mr. Chair, and I think we have had issues in the past where we've dealt on at least a few occasions of people who had service outside, and we've looked at them on a case-by-case basis. We don't really have an established policy for doing so. It would strike me, though, that if Mr. Biegert were to pull the money out of his Montana plan, he probably wouldn't have any benefits in the Montana plan. And if,
right.
if TRA wants, how much is it? whatever amount that they're looking for, I got it. No,
but the issue is, I mean, if you're going to go 10 years, I mean, you got the 11.2. I mean, we don't have a policy right now. We used to have a policy 10 years. Some purchases are 5 years. I guess if you're going to make them whole, if I were arguing for Mr. Biegert, I would say, let me buy the 11.2 years. It's a little bit more money. I don't know why you're leaving this tail out there of 1.2, and it would be proportionately more, and we could calculate that.
Senator Bledsoe, why don't you make a motion that on this one we tentatively move forward, but that TRA do some work with Mr. Biegert and just make sure that you've thought through all the various aspects of this from a personal perspective, and then let's kind of revisit it after we see where that's at.
Mr. Chair, I'll make the tentative motion. And if Mr. Biegert does decide that he doesn't want to proceed with this, it's fairly easy to take something out of a bill. It's harder to put it in a bill. No.
Okay, so Bledsoe's motion is?
Yes. To move Senate File 1736 and House File 1978. There are no amendments.
Okay.
And as I said, if Mr. Biegert wants us to take it out, I'll be happy to move to take it out.
Mr. Thompson, will you do some work with Mr. Biegert just to make sure he's not a remorseful buyer at some point?
Yes, Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Mr. Chairman, thank members, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Day. Senator LeClaire and Representative Sharon. Larry, this number 7 on the agenda.
Members, this is Senate File 1995, House File 2196. This has to do with a public defender who had service during the period 1987 to 1993 that was relatively nominal compared to their private practice of law service. As such, the person was excluded at one point from PERA coverage and now wants to purchase service credits. The bill is drafted for a full six-year period. There is one amendment, the A1 amendment, which reduces that purchase down to 21 months. My understanding is that PERA and the individual have discussed what is appropriately covered by PERA and what is not, and PERA has determined that 21 months could be covered by PERA appropriately.
Okay. PERA, Ms. Vanek. Senator LeClaire indicates that you've worked through this and...
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. We've been working with Ms. Duffy for the last 18 months, so to speak, and we did indicate to her that the full period of service we could not support a purchase of because she wasn't eligible. Okay. In fact, she brought it to our attention that she wasn't eligible. But in reviewing the tax records, she did exceed the 25% threshold of professional compensation. So she could have been covered for 1992 calendar year and the first 9 months of 1993. The 10th month, she was enrolled in MSRS, so she has that coverage. So we do not oppose the actuarial purchase of those 21 months.
Okay, so we need Senate File 1995, House File 2196 with the A1 amendment.
I'm moving.
Senator Michelle moves that. Ms. Duffy, did you want some? Would you like to add anything? Or
I don't think there's really anything I can add. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You haven't heard the cost yet.
Oh, yes. How much?
I gotta make sure I have the right letter. Mr. Chair, members, the cost to make the purchase is roughly $12,219.
Okay. So on the Michelle motion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Very nice to be with you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator LeClaire, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, we can't do MSRSs. Oh, okay, we can do that. Let's do number 11, Representative Hoppe. Mr. Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Martin.
Members, you have two bills here, but they relate to the same individual in the same circumstance. They just differ as to the amount of the service credit purchase payment that would be due. The basic issue here is a police officer who left employment for a period of time to serve as a business agent, a period of 18 months, then returned to PERA, Police and Fire Service, and there was no provision in the law for covering that union business agent service, and he now wants to purchase that service. If it had been covered as PERA covers it for non-police and fire, there would have been a limit of 1 year of service credit that could be obtained for the business agent service. So the issue is one bill provides for just the contributions that would have been made at the time, not the full actuarial value. That's 2025. House File 2026 is the full actuarial value, which is the traditional standard that the Pension Commission has used. So you have a choice between which bill based on whether you want to charge full actuarial value or do something other than that. There are a couple of amendments. The amendments, if you want to provide for coverage in PERA general for this non-public safety service, have amendments, the A1 amendments for whichever bill you choose. And we do raise a collateral issue having to do with the Minnesota Sheriff's Organization, which is comparable to the union business agent, they are currently in potentially PERA coverage, even though it's not public safety employment. And we don't normally cover non-public safety employment in a public pension plan, in a public safety pension plan. So that's something that is a historical relic, and if it's collateral to this issue, but I did want to raise it because you may never see it again or may never I'll become aware of it. So maybe you want to sort out the individual involved and then get to the collateral issue later if you so choose.
What this might be, I was surprised to see that this is actually an issue in the Minneapolis and St. Paul funds. Isn't this already covered in some fashion? I thought that was a predetermined. I was just surprised to see that this was an issue. What's going on with the Minnetonka situation that I would have just thought you would have been covered automatically as the business rep?
Under 179A, we're allowed to, take a position with our union as our exclusive representative, either in an elected or an appointed position. So I was appointed a business agent. I would have been able to purchase back my service had I done that within 1 year of returning to service. At that time, kept my money liquid to provide for the care for my wife, who passed away from cancer in 1999. Since then, I've been trying to make this purchase of the service credit back. Senator, I just want to clarify that I'm not looking for anything more than I would have been able to purchase within that first year. There is some confusion during the drafting of the bills.
Mr. Chair and members, the reason we have two bills here is we had some conflicting advice. When we were drafting bills, we had two drafted, and we stand to the wisdom of the committee as to which one we should proceed with.
I think 2026 is the one we would deal with.
That's what we were thinking, too, until we heard some of the previous testimony, and then we were in some doubt after that, but we're willing to bow to the wisdom of the committee.
So the issue really is that you missed the one-year window.
That's correct, sir.
Didn't miss it. You, for reasons, chose not to.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Maybe you ought to get permanent residency up here. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. We have calculated the actuarial value just the 1 year. Our record clearly indicates there was only 12 months of missed service credit, which is why we're saying that the bill should not be drafted 1.5 years. The cost in the police and fire fund would be $23,084. We did calculate in the coordinated plan because the issue was raised in staff memo about whether it should be police and fire or coordinated service. The point to make, however, is that if he would have made the purchase of that unpaid leave within the 1 year, he would have purchased it in the police and fire fund, and he would have gotten that credit. I believe we should take the position that he would have had it, so the purchase in the police and fire fund in this instance may be appropriate, but it does raise up a bigger issue for future discussion on allowing those who take a leave for this type of activity, which is the appropriate plan coverage.
Members?
Served as a business agent.
So what are your comments about 12 versus 18?
There's some confusion in the time that I was gone. I was gone actually 15 months from my employment at Minnetonka.
Mr. Chair, members, if I may address that, his record with PERA, however, shows that contributions came in for part of that period of time. So I don't know if he was on paid time or vacation time, what kind of leave he may have been taken. The unpaid period is 12 months only.
I would defer to the record of the PERA.
Pardon me?
I would defer to the record of the PERA.
So we would need to a verbal amendment to do that in the bill. So we're looking at 2026 as amended to 1 year. And do members want to deal with these other two issues at this time or cogitate them? So Thiessen moves House File 2026 at 1 year be incorporated. Ms. Vanek, does that work for you?
It's $23,084.
Is it Lieutenant?
Sergeant.
Sergeant?
Not Lieutenant yet.
Not Lieutenant yet. Sergeant, does that work for you?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Appreciate it. Okay.
Mull it over.
Who else has been waiting? Should we go to Nienau, Senator Nienau's bill, number 5? Good morning.
Good morning, members. Mr. Chairman, members.
Let's have Mr. Burrick give us a brief review. Mr. Burke.
Members, due to some language that was added by amendment, the position at Rush City for the psychologist too was added to the correctional plan. However, the individual received only half a loaf in that there was no language that allowed the individual to transfer comparable service into the correctional plan. So that would be a transfer of that service from MSRS General to MSRS Correctional. In the past, the commission and legislature generally has allowed comparable past service to transfer, but not always. So that's an issue for you. And if you do decide that comparable service should transfer, another issue would be just on what terms. The bill as drafted is consistent with the way the commission has generally done things. However, that process doesn't make the correctional plan whole. And commission members will recall that a week or so back, we were looking at actuarial work for that plan and a benefit, not a benefit increase, but a contribution increase for that plan of over 7% of payroll. So that plan is not in the best actuarial shape right now, and the commission has taken or is proposing to take a considerable action to address that problem. Now, given that situation, the commission may wish to pay some attention to just what terms that transfer is on, whether it's on a subsidized basis or whether the commission will insist that it be transferred in a manner and in an amount that would not harm that correctional plan further. So with those comments, I turn it back to the chair.
MSRS.
Is he here?
He's coming.
Is it true you were talking with the IRS this morning?
Mr. Chair, it is true that I was talking to the IRS. It was not a pleasant conversation.
You know, whenever you hear someone's got a meeting with the IRS, you all go, oh, gosh.
Mr. Chair, the only good thing is I didn't have to go to the dentist before that. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the State Retirement System. And these types of purchases have been done for most of the people moving over from the general plan to the correctional plan. In 2004, when this person was allowed to move over, there are two individuals that I'm aware of were not able to give a choice. The actuarial sort of cost to the plan would be in the neighborhood of about $40,000 between the two of them. The one question I raise from a policy standpoint is the interest rate charged to the employee. It is On the second page, we're looking at charging 6%, where with repayment or refunds, it's generally 8.5%. I believe 6% has been done in the past. Based on the financial instability of the plan right now, I think that might be something to look at from a policy standpoint if we want to change the interest rate on the amount due from the employee on these purchases. So this is consistent with what happened in the past. These two individuals were left out, but you know, there might want to be some consideration to the amount that's paid. So.
Okay. So members, what do we want here in terms of amendments?
Just to clarify, so the earlier folks transferred 6%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deason, yes, that's correct.
And they're kind of equivalent in every way?
It's like three people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deason, yes.
Apparently, the way the bill is drafted potentially covers three people. Is there something we need to do here to designate the two that we're talking about?
When we asked for names, we only had the names of two. So the third person's probably covered. I just wasn't aware of that individual.
But which positions?
Which positions are we talking?
I just have a Mr. Todd and a Mr. Burkholm.
I just have the names.
I don't have the specific position.
So we'll need some work on that, I think. The drafting. Mr. Martin?
Members, one of the two individuals is the psychologist, too. The bill also covers a corrections discipline unit supervisor and a dental hygienist. And if we're going to, the A4 amendment would leave only the psychologist, too, in the bill. That obviously doesn't fit the fact circumstance. So we're trying to identify the employment position to know which two people to of the three to leave in the bill.
Mr. Chair, the one I'm missing is the discipline unit supervisor. That would be the name that I do not have, that I would have to get to look up the account.
My understanding, members, is that the discipline unit supervisor was actually a lieutenant who was acting in that capacity and was already in the plan by virtue of being a correctional lieutenant. That was my understanding last year or 2 years ago when this happened. If that hasn't changed, we could presumably do away with the correctional discipline supervisor position because that's not apparently in play.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is a lot. I was only aware of the two when I checked, and if they were already covered, there would be no reason to purchase it, and that's probably why they didn't kick out on the list.
Senator, does that make sense, these two positions, as far
yes.
as you know?
Yes.
So what is the what's the package we need here? For the Thiessen motion.
We'll give you a start at least. If you want to address the two people rather than three, you would take A4, but you would only remove the corrections discipline unit supervisor
okay.
rather than both. If you want to address Mr. Bergstrom's concern about the appropriate interest rate on the member contribution, it's currently specified at 6. The normal practice has been 8.5. That would be a verbal amendment to page 2, line 22, deleting 6 and inserting 8.5.
Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment.
A1 does that.
Has that.
Okay.
And then Mr. Burek can tell us about the other two amendments.
A2 and A3, Mr. Burek.
Mr. Chairman, members, the A2 amendment and A3 amendment are efforts to keep the plan whole, and the difference between the two is just how you decide is an appropriate method to keep the plan whole. The A2 amendment would require the plan to receive the full actuarial value, and the employer any additional employer contribution needed to bring the total payment and transfers up to the full actuarial value would be covered by the Department of Corrections. The A3 amendment is similar, except rather than transferring the full actuarial value, it would transfer the funded portion of that so that the plan's funding ratio would not change as a result of this. So the plan's 80% funded, the plan would receive 80% of the full actuarial value. So it's up to you which of those you feel is an appropriate approach.
If I can comment, if this point. Members, historically, because the correctional plan was essentially a single employer pension plan, there were only two agencies that were the employer of the members of the plan. When we've made past service transfers, we have never charged the employer any additional amount at that time because they owed the unfunded liability sooner or later anyway. And the plan was very, very well funded. We never previously were concerned about that. Now that the plan is not very well funded, it still only covers two employers, but it's not a very well-funded plan. Relying on just a normal course of contributions to the plan over time doesn't seem to be the best approach, and that's why Mr. Burek is raising some additional contributions by the department involved. So doing something about speeding up, having more contributions at an earlier time makes sense. And so one of the two amendments is a departure from past practice, but it's based on a changing factual circumstance, the poor condition of the poor actuarial condition of the plan.
Mr. Bergstrom, comment on either of those?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was in 1996 when they brought a bunch of the correctional plan members over, I think Representative Murphy carried the bill. We actually increased the employee and employer contributions at that time to cover adding this group and allowing the past purchase. Then what subsequently has happened is that funding has deteriorated and other people have been brought into the plan without that additional change. We are currently looking at increasing the contribution rates substantially, where back then we were well funded, and Representative Murphy's bill actually did keep the plan whole until they started adding on in 98, 99, 2000. One thing, and as you look at another bill that I would maybe recommend, because there are about 30 some people the department is interested in adding in addition to these two people buying back, and I have sent that list over to the actuary. And what might be a good idea is to take this provision and all of those other bills and get the actuary to determine what the impact would be based on what we're looking for. You know, if the group is younger at all, it actually may not cost the plan anything, you know, depending on the makeup. So I think what might be helpful is if we could take the bills that you're interested in, I could run them by the actuary. That way we would be sure we're not running into any problems. And I've already sent the correction department group in, but there was one missing that I just heard about yesterday. And then I think we have a couple more. Then I could just bring in all of the actuarial work so we would know what the results would be.
Okay, so thank you. So Thiessen moves Senate File 1676, House File 1928 with the A1 and the A4 amendments. And the A4 amendment only includes the discipline unit supervisor. And then we will just keep in the back of our mind here the A2 and A3 amendments for further consideration.
Senator Betzel.
To clarify, on the A4, we are including or removing?
I think we're taking out the discipline unit supervisor.
Gotcha. Okay.
Mr. Chair, and maybe I missed this, A4 looks like they're deleting two positions.
No, we're not taking out the dental hygienist.
Okay, great.
I just wanted to clarify. Who apparently is got a different position is already covered.
And I'll double check that when I go back. We'll see if there's a problem. But
okay. On the Thiessen motion.
Mr. Chair, the department is here. I wonder if they want to comment.
Okay.
Is there any problems from your viewpoint?
Do we have those other bills on? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Karen McCarty. I'm the Human Resource Manager for the Department of Corrections. Discipline Unit Supervisor currently serves as a Corrections Program Director and is not covered by the plan. It is my understanding he was a lieutenant before, but I think that we should defer and look at the service credit for all of the positions covered, not delete the discipline unit supervisor.
okay, why don't we keep it in for now? So we're not going to do the A4. Can you get back to the staff on that?
I will.
And Mr. Bergstrom, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I just, from my notes here, I didn't hear what the A1 amendment was.
The A1 is the percent.
Okay.
The
compound interest.
The compound interest percent.
8.5.
Yes. Okay, so.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, by including that, we're going to come back with the
right
numbers.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Why don't you both stay here, the department, and Mr. Bergstrom will take these other two bills. Thank you, Senator Nino.
Thank you, members.
Appreciate it. Let's look at number one and number 10. Why don't we have, I think the department can be quicker on this to tell us where are we at on 1 and 10, what's going on?
Mr. Chairman, members, our data indicates that the delivery van driver class and the laundry coordinators do meet the statutory requirements for coverage, so we would support that.
And that's been worked out with the employee group?
Yes.
Okay. Staff, who's Larry? This is number one.
Yes, members, number one would move laundry coordinators and delivery van drivers at the Faribault facility into the correctional plan. They're not currently in the plan. It would also cover their past service, transfer their past service. I couldn't quite hear the testimony from the corrections department. My understanding is historically the corrections department had not supported the delivery van driver change. Is there a change now?
Correct.
On that?
We examined the data when we saw this bill yesterday. I contacted the Faribault facility, and in fact, they had one individual with more than the 75% time. They had simply had not submitted it to my office in time to get it in our process, but for this bill, we do have the documentation supporting it.
Okay, and we need the A1, not the A2. And how about the A3?
Requires the A3 is the same issue that we just talked about with the Nino bill about the appropriate amount of money that our corrections should pay, and that will depend upon
a
potentially different procedure of having the actuary look at the individuals actually involved.
Okay, so Senator Langseth moves Senate File 503-441 with the A1 amendment, and then we'll keep in mind the A3 amendment. Okay, I think that's what you want. And the employee group is comfortable with this set of discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay, then a little trickier is the next one, number 10. Mr. Bergstrom, we're assuming you were okay with number one.
Mr. Chair, based on the actuarial work we're doing,
yeah, right.
I'm okay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Ed, Mr. Burke.
Members, this bill, number 10 on the agenda, involves an individual who was in a position that had correctional plan coverage, and then moved to a position as the correctional program director. The correctional program director is covered by MSRS General. The individual then, late in her career, moved back to the previous employment as a corrections lieutenant, again covered by the correctional plan. And what the individual is now requesting is that employment as a correctional as the corrections program director, which is an MSRS general covered position, to the best of my knowledge, she now wants that to be covered by the correctional plan. It raises a lot of issues. I will allow you to just look at the memo and the policy issues for that one. But unless there is a good argument why that particular position belongs in the correctional plan, then there just doesn't seem to be much justification.
Uh, Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the State Retirement System. My concern in this proposal is that the corrections program director position is not covered by the correctional plan. So in this instance, you would be able to add coverage that is covered by the general plan and transfer it over to the correctional plan, even though that position was never eligible in that correctional plan. And to me, that is a major distinction. In the past, when people could switch coverage, they would buy like positions or positions eligible for the correctional plan where this one was not. And I think it would set a precedent for allowing people to purchase time in that plan that was never intended to be in that program. And I think there is a distinction here from the other purchases.
Members, I've talked with the Department of Corrections, and this person is in a employee class or group that is going to be under consideration for transfer. The issue is that this person, and are you the person?
Yes, I am.
Okay, you are Ms. McShay?
That's correct, sir.
And apparently you are about to retire or consider retiring here very soon?
Well, it depends where my children decide to go to college.
And so this particular employee's issue would be that if we allow the normal process, last year we set up this process where we wanted the agency to work through these classifications and recommend to us which ones should be transferred. And this particular group of employees, they have not gotten to yet, but are going to consider that during the interim this year. And there is a likelihood that the recommendation will be to move this class of employees, this group of employees. Not for certain, but a possibility. And so I think Mr. Bergstrom's point is, well, you can't do this for one employee if the whole group isn't going to be. And we have not yet gone through the process that we set up last year to find out if this whole group is going to. And so what I'm thinking we should do here, it's kind of a half a loaf. If the group is moved, we could make sure that if you do retire, you are covered. If the group is not moved, then it's not going to make any difference if you retire this year, next year, or the year after. And there may be some technical aspects that have to be worked out on that, but I'm wondering if that isn't a way to handle this so we don't get the cart before the horse. And I think the agency is comfortable with this. Why don't we hear? They don't want to predispose what the decision's going to be on this group of employees, but I mean, they have some information, so let's just get a sense of what the department's thinking is here.
Chairman, members, Carrie McCarty again from the department. We do support the process and the ability to look at these jobs for consideration.
And members might recall we set this process up last year to protect ourselves so that we would know whether we're going to do this for a whole group of employees or not. So why don't we, Representative, we're going to come up with some language that provides some semblance of certainty to Ms. McShay, but it would only happen if the whole group is moved, and that's something that wouldn't happen until next year. So hopefully we can draft something that allows you to make a decision that makes sense for your family here and doesn't prejudice you one way or the other with regards to this future decision. And we just need to figure out if we can come up with some language to do that. Okay?
Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So it's too important, I think, to keep to the process here and not move individual employees before we've had a chance to look at the whole group. Okay? So I think Senator Bedsell moves that we examine some language that accomplishes what I just described, which is an attempt to allow some retroactivity if the judgment is made next year to move the entire group of employees. So, okay. On the Bedsell motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
This is kind of a placeholder.
That's a place, kind of a placeholder, but there would actually be some language in the bill.
Okay.
So, and I think we want to stay in touch. If you would keep in touch with the department about where you're headed here in the next 2 or 3 months, that could help us. If you for some reason decide you're not going to retire, then we don't need to worry about anything.
At this point, I can tell you within the next 2 to 3 months, I will not be retired.
Okay.
So I will be having further conversation.
Okay. Would you please? And just kind of work with the department. They want to work with you on this. And okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I'm down to seniority. Senator Skoglund? Sorry, the members that are sitting here. I'm down to seniority. Senator Skoglund, is there something that I know that is maybe not as generally known here that we should know here today or not?
Try new.
What?
Maybe in a little while.
Okay.
Yeah. In a little while. But yes, you're right.
Okay.
Ms. Chairman, members of the committee, with me is Ms. Shelley Siegel. Ms. Shelley Siegel is an employee of MNSCU.
Why don't we have the staff give us a heads up about what we're talking about here. Mr. Brick, this is number 14.
Members, there's two sets of bills here providing slightly different treatment. Let me first state what the issue is, and then you can decide which of the two bills might be appropriate. The individual is a MNSCU employee, has been for many years, and in 1994, individuals who were MNSCU employees at that time, which and Ms. Siegel was an employee at that time, they were to be given the authority to decide if they wanted TRA coverage instead of the IRAP coverage that they had been provided with. And this was because technical colleges were being merged into MNSCU at that point. These employees were given a choice. And so I think the feeling was if these employees who are newly entering the MNSCU system are being given this choice, then perhaps we should give the same option to the existing employees. So all the existing employees in 94 were to be given this choice of deciding whether they wanted to move into TRA coverage. Ms. Siegel contends that she was not given the option, and there is some evidence, and it's in your packet, that indicates that she was not sent the materials to make that election. Apparently, she was supposed to be given that option by certified mail, and the records indicate that she wasn't given that particular option. On the other hand, one could argue that there are some personal responsibility issues. Even if the individual wasn't given this election option by mail, there should have been plenty of notice that this was happening, and the individual perhaps should have been aware of it and contacted the necessary individuals to make sure that that she had that option. You have two sets of bills before you, and the first set would allow Ms. Siegel to have TRA coverage at this point and retroactive to the start of 1995, which is the approximate date that the election would have occurred, with the transfer of some assets from her account to make the situation as similar as possible to what would have occurred at the start of 1995. The second set of bills, and the second set is Senate File 2248, House File 2462, would allow the same end result, the current TRA coverage with some transfer of past service, but the bulk of the cost would be placed on the individual. So the full actuarial value would be something that would be the responsibility of Ms. Siegel to cover. The first one, Senate File 2247, instead puts the bulk of that responsibility on MNSCU. And that first one would be justified if the commission were to conclude that MNSCU harmed the individual by not providing her with the coverage transfer materials back in the late 94. For those comments, I turn it over to the commission.
Okay. What? Let's hear from the fund.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, may I just for a moment?
Sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Burke wrote an excellent memo and described it very well. There's two other things I'd like to add. It's documented both in Mr. Burke's memo and in the letter attached in the packet you received that she has, that she, well, both the campus and Wells Fargo checked your files and found there was no election, indicating to us that you were not given the election. In other words, there was no documentation. They wrote everybody by certified mail. She never got a certified letter like everybody else got. She's like most people who think retirement, they think retirement. They don't know defined contribution from defined benefit. Smart as she is, she was in a pension plan as far as she was concerned. She later learned that she was not in a defined benefit plan. She learned it at a retirement meeting, and she said, how do I get in? They checked the records, found that she had never been admitted, and said, yes, you can go in. She was admitted to TRA. They took money from her check in TRA and later said, whoops, you can't do that. You're not in it anymore, and they kicked her out of TRA. So she's been even admitted to the TRA plan for, what, a half year or so? Then they kicked her out of TRA saying you should have done it in 2005 when you had a chance to take this election.
They removed her.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They removed her. Very politely removed her, very gently. So she's been in the system and is not now due to an error on TRA's, or error on the system's part.
Want to hear from Minsky first or not? Representative Murphy.
Senator Skoglund, did she get her money back from TRA then at the time?
Siegel.
I believe I did. I believe they retroactively put it back into IRAP, my IRAP account. In March, they began taking payroll deductions in July, and then when the transactions started to occur, when they started to roll the money over, I think that's when they were alerted to the fact that they didn't want to pay, that there was a cost involved. So I received a phone call saying that I was not going to be further admitted and everything would roll back to my IRAP.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, just a phone call? You never got anything in writing?
Correct. I don't think I did. It was a phone call from my human resources office.
Minsky, TRA, does anybody want to help enlighten us here?
Chairman, members of the commission, Luther Thompson. Of course, you know, we would certainly love to have Shelley Siegel in our fund, but as, you know, as fiduciaries, we have to follow the guidance from the legislature and the statutes, and as fiduciaries, the bottom line is, you know, we have to show us the money. We have here, the cost of this is $95,877. Okay. There's an additional cost of $10,757 to PARA. The total cost is $106,634. In the bill, we've calculated that Ms. Siegel would have to, from 1995 on, pay the difference in the contributions, the increased contributions between TRA and IRAP, plus interest, that would so she would pay $6,670. There is the IRAP money since January 1st, 1995, of $42,950. That leaves a cost of $46,256 plus the $10,757 to Minsky. To PARA. So the dispute here is over the $57,000. Who pays? Should Ms. Siegel pay or should Minsky pay?
So you're doing your Pontius Pilate again? As long as somebody pays, you can live with it?
It's not, we don't, we'd love to have
it. Thank you, Mr.
But it's, that's the, you know, that's the, that's the cost. You know, we need, you know, we need the money to make, be whole.
Thank you. Minsky is just rushing up here. You may want to leave the scene, Mr. Thompson. Welcome.
Oh, Gary Janikowski. I am System Director for Personnel with Minsku. And this is Mary Millar next to me, who has done some of the research on this as well. We are opposed to Senate File 2247. We are not opposed to Senate File 2248. When this issue first surfaced, Ms. Siegel is relying on the correspondence in your documentation from Wells Fargo, who is our third-party administrator for the plan. Wells Fargo was never the administrator for the former community college system. This issue occurred back in 1994, which is prior to the merger. And the community colleges used, I'm not really certain who they utilized to do their elections, but Wells Fargo only worked for the state universities at the time. Subsequent to the merger, Wells Fargo was hired to serve as administrative agent for all of Minsku. And the records they had at the time, they did not have all of the records. The campuses in some cases had these records. The Wells Fargo had some of these records. But there were also some records that were in off-site storage. Because of the age of this issue, we did have Ms. Millar here go through the archives, which were in off-site storage in boxes, literally went through many, many boxes, and was able to locate a list that was used in the elections process in the community colleges, and Ms. Siegel's name is on that list. Unfortunately, there is not a returned certified mail receipt for that particular election. We do have some folks
For any of the employees? Or
no, we do have some of the certified copies for some of the employees. But
in that particular mailing?
In that particular mailing,
okay.
Yes. So we've got mixed result. And maybe Ms. Millar can talk further about what she found.
Mr. Chair, members, in our off-site storage, there were actually 9 boxes sent from the community college system and that had been transferred over to Minsku, and all those boxes went to storage. Because of the age of the issue, some of the boxes had already been destroyed. We did find 3 that were not, and the mailing lists, samples of correspondence, all of those items, some computer printouts were in those boxes, but the boxes that contained the certified mail receipts, due to the records retention schedule and the people who take care of the off-site storage, some of the boxes had already been destroyed. But we do have a mailing list that shows Ms. Siegel's name on the list that was used during the process, and at that time, what we could reconstruct, because I went back and I interviewed some of the people who had retired, who had actually been involved in the process, that the CC board generated a list, gave it to the State University Board personnel who were actually doing the mailing, provided them with this list, said these are the folks who need to be mailed, notices that they have this election option. State University Board actually did all the mailing and then charged postage. There are actually some notations on the list of the people who had actually returned elections. I would note that on the sample election form that we did find in the box, that those individuals who wanted to retain their current coverage could just opt to not return the form.
I can add one thing also. I was on a campus in 1994 where we had elections as well as part of this process. And what I recall was that there was a lot of publicity at the time in campus newsletters and in other mailings that went out in general. So in addition to the individualized mailing, there was other promotion, if you will, of this election process.
Questions?
Chairman, Ms. Siegel says she never received the letter. Doesn't mean you got it. The reason one sends things by certified mail is to get that receipt, to retain that receipt, to demonstrate that it arrived. That's why you do it. So I
can't imagine if they have had it, somebody would have
discarded. I just can't imagine that. That's why you send a certified letter, is to get that card back.
Well, is Senator Scogin 2248 allows for some relief, but doesn't have Minsku pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, 2248 is a bill that would allow Siegel to transfer all of her IRAP funds into ERA.
Mm-hmm.
No, until about 20 minutes ago. It's not enough. It's asking a lot to ask her to, you know, don't remember the figure, $40,000, $50,000 all of a sudden.
106 total.
62. She has 62,000. We learned just outside the door, she has 62,000 in her IRAP funds, which she thinks should be transferred. Even before we had the discussion in the hallway a few minutes ago, she didn't know how much was there, but she always told me, yeah, you take that money and shift it over. But she didn't know that she was going to owe $40,000 more. She's a little bit in shell shock right now, having been. I am too. Responsible for.
We have Senator Skoglund. There's a number of other issues along this same line, mm-hmm. and it starts adding up to real money for Minsku. And so, on ones like this, we have to be pretty careful. Perhaps what we ought to do is have further discussion between Minsku, yourself, and just kind of see where we're at and further consideration of this a little at a next.
Mr. Chairman, I told the CEO that that would be like the outcome of this meeting. And she has a cousin who works in this field who would.
That'd be fine with us. I mean,
that's fine.
It's fine with Minsky, I suppose.
I just finally want to add, she was in. They took her in. They moved her, I think is the polite term we're using. And I think we have to think that some actions she could take away from this committee, which we don't want to have happen. So.
Well, in this instance, it doesn't appear that TRA itself is culpable in any way.
Right.
And so we would want to make them financially whole with whatever we do. And so the options basically, I think, get down to Minsku versus the individual employee in terms of who might pay and who might not. So we are, and just so you know, we're confronted with many of these issues like this, and it seems like it would be a simple thing just to say deep pockets can do this. Well, it's not quite that simple, because when you add up 10 or 15 of these, we're talking billions of dollars. And so I think we need to just get a little further discussion with Minsku and yourself about what actually happened with regards to the letters and so forth, okay? Okay. Thank you. We'll set this one aside then for some further discussion. We'll bring it back up again at some point and make a determination, but thank you. Okay, I think Representative Johnson, do you have more seniority than Lincheski?
Yeah.
Do you? Get in here then. Is that correct or not? Come on, you're up next. Okay. Do you have more seniority? Then you're very gracious. Okay.
I owe you one, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, and Senator Bonhoff, welcome.
Thank
you.
You.
For members of the House, this is newly elected Senator Bonhoff from Minnetonka. Welcome. Okay, whose is this? This is Larry, number 15 on the agenda.
Yes, members, I'll give you a quick factual circumstance. This is an individual who once was a Richfield police officer, spent about 5 years in Richfield, which gave him enough time to vest for a partial benefit from the former Richfield Police Our Relief Association, then became a Minneapolis police officer in 1983. As such, because it was after the June 15th, 1980 date for phasing out the local plans, he was a member of PERA Police and Fire, not the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund. And this individual now wants to combine his Richfield time with his Minneapolis time in a single PERA Police and Fire pension.
Okay. Anything to add to that explanation? Officer Lenson, is it?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, could I just say one thing?
Please.
we recognize that you're going to have concerns about precedent with respect to this. It may go back to some similarity with the last case up there. And we drafted a bill that was specific to Sergeant Lenzen rather than a bill that brought in everyone who may be similar to him. We're certainly open to discussions with respect to a broader bill, but we were trying to keep this as inexpensive as possible. And we also recognize that something similar to this has been granted at least once before, even though it's also been denied in the past. So we're appreciative of your willingness to at least discuss Sergeant Lenzen's situation. I don't know if Senator Bonoff had anything to add or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I'm Terry Bonoff. As Mr. Chairman said, I am the newly elected senator, so this is all very new to me, and I'm taking it all in and learning and appreciate what is happening here. The only thing I have to add is Sergeant Lenzen is as a constituent that I think it's important to recognize a lifetime of service and appreciate that he has dedicated his career to public service.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I may. My issue isn't just that I want to combine them. When I left Richfield, I was vested, as was said. I was vested in the Richfield pension, and I went to Minneapolis and became a PERA member in Minneapolis. About 6 or 7 years after I had been a member of PERA, Minneapolis officer, PERA absorbed the Richfield pension. All of my coworkers were given full PERA credit for their years of service. I assumed that I also was getting full credit for my years of service with Richfield. Only to find out about 14, 15 months ago that I didn't get credit when all of my coworkers did for the same service period for the same contribution, and that is my issue.
I think I might have missed the point of the comparison to these other people.
All of the officers that I served with in Richfield all got full PERA credit for their years of service that they had put into their retirement accounts. Because I wasn't an active police officer in Richfield, I was an active police officer in Minneapolis, I got left behind somehow. They got full credit, I got no credit from PERA for those years of service. And that is my issue.
How many years was it in Richfield?
Four and a half years, sir.
Four and a half years, okay. Okay, let's hear, thank you. Let's hear from the fund in Richfield, Minneapolis. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. With all due respect to Mr. Lenzen, I do have documentation in the file that when the Richfield Relief Association did consolidate with PERA, he did receive a letter from us welcoming him to the administration of their plan under us, and that he, as a deferred member of a local relief association, your monthly benefit will be based on the laws and bylaws of your relief association. It stated that specifically in his welcome letter. He was at the time a deferred member, which meant he had a right to a future benefit but was no longer actively participating through Richfield. And then subsequently in 1999, when we merged the funds, we did allow individuals at that time to tell us immediately whether or not they were going to elect to have post-retirement adjustments through the post fund or stay with the relief association provisions. And I do have a document signed by Mr. Lenzen on July 19, 1999, received in our office on August 3rd that indicates that he wanted to participate in the post fund for future increases. But the letters that went out also specifically stated that his initial benefit would be based on relief association bylaws. There was no the law was specifically written to keep deferred members under the bylaws of the relief association for calculating the pension and not to give credit in the in PERA Police and Fire Fund, because that benefit had essentially been paid for. The person had left, and the city had some indication of what the costs were going to be. This does set a significant precedent. You have heard bills in the past, as the staff memo points out. I And I apologize. I meant to look yesterday, but I know that Mr. Wellness provision got through, but I don't think it made it all the way through final passage. Larry, did it? No. And I can't tell you specifically how many contacts I had over the years after the consolidation law was passed in 1987, but I've dealt with this issue in the different positions I've held at PERA. We have consistently told them that the law did not really did anticipate this situation and specifically was written not to give credit in para PNF for this type of service. So there is a cost, and we calculated it similar to how we calculated Mr. Wellness. We figured the cost of PERA with the additional Richfield service. The value of that is $814,088. Without that service, it's $708,047. Difference $106,041. The value of his Relief Association benefit that he is currently entitled to is $46,933. So the difference that we would expect to be paid to us if this advances is $59,108.
Can we get a copy of those letters? You have. Okay. Sergeant?
May I respond?
Sure.
I have no argument with anything that she said. She's absolutely correct. The only issue that I have is with PERA. I was a member of PERA when the merger took place, and they did not ask me if I wanted to have my ears transferred over. I was totally ignored. People that were not members of PERA, the Richfield police officers, all got this benefit. But I was a member of PERA and had been for years and was not offered this benefit by PERA. So my issue, I don't argue with what she said. My issue is with PERA and how I was treated by my own retirement association at the time.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Members, Mr. Lenzen, Officer Lenzen, the law didn't allow us to extend to you the opportunity to have those years transferred in the Police and Fire Fund. The law was very specific that even though you were a member of Para Police and Fire based on subsequent service to Richfield, that there was no opportunity for you to get credit for that time in our Police and Fire Fund. So if we didn't extend it to you, it's because it was not allowed.
Okay, and I understand and appreciate that. And then in that case, my issue is with the law.
You're in the right place for that.
Exactly. That would allow for some people to get benefits and other people don't. I would liken it to if all of you were getting paid by the state of Minnesota tomorrow, but this guy on the end in the white shirt doesn't get paid because he's got a white shirt on, and he's at the end. It's just arbitrary.
Well, we've been considering it for other reasons. He's a lawyer, works for Fagerty Benson, so we've been considering other possibilities, but... He makes enough at Fagerty Benson. He doesn't need the state to chip in. We're just kidding. I'm just kidding. So Minneapolis or Richfield want to add anything?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I'm Steve Devich, City Manager, City of Richfield. By way of a very brief background, I've been with the City of Richfield since 1980. From 80 to 84, I was human resources manager, and from 85 through 2004, I was the administrative services director, city treasurer, and assistant city manager. In the late 80s and in 91, during consolidation, I was also a voting member of the Police Relief Association. Excuse me. It was our understanding going through that process, and we had a lot of discussion about consolidation, that as a deferred member, Mr. Lenzen, like any other deferred member, had one option under the law, and that was to make an election as to how his post-retirement increases would be based, whether on the Relief Association or under PERA. Everyone was notified appropriately from our perspective. From the city's perspective also, through consolidation, it certainly is the city's understanding that there be no further obligation. For example, paying a portion of the buyback of the actuarial value is something that's absolutely not the way it was presented to us when we went through consolidation. It just simply, I just think that from what my understanding of the law and what our obligations were through consolidation, that cannot be a part of it.
Thank you. Questions? Glad to see you and Richfield are working together.
Thank you.
Always.
Mr. Chairman, Karen Lowry Wagner with the City of Minneapolis. And my comments are going to echo a lot of what's already been said by Ms. Vanek. We are concerned about the precedent this type of situation does set for the city. While the dollar amount is not significant, like I said, we're concerned what other cases may be happening. We're a little confused as to the role the city now plays as the current employer, and just, like I said, confused by this, concerned about some precedent and what type of cases this may lead to in the future.
Questions?
Thank you. Representative and Senator, I think this is a dicey one. I think unless there's something here that doesn't meet the eye, the commission's going to be pretty hard-pressed to do this. Is there anything that we maybe don't understand here at this point? And Sergeant, I think we understand the point you're making from an employee's perspective. But whether it was a good law or not at the time, it is the law. And this whole consolidation thing was really worked over quite heavily by the commission and by the legislature. And we tried to anticipate all the various aspects of what would happen next. And I think it is important, Ms. Vanek, from the fund's perspective, they could not offer you that. They didn't have that option. So,
if I may make one last
Sergeant,
comment, sir.
Yes.
Thank you. My understanding, when this law was enacted in June of 1980, one of the major reasons for it was because various police departments, various cities had their own pensions set up. That most often would require an officer to stay there for 20 years in order to be vested in the system. And PERA, the state passed a law in 1980 to eliminate that, to allow officers to have and firefighters to have mobility between police departments. It just seems that I'm the victim of the law that was enacted to rectify the situation because I moved from one police department to another. It just seems fundamentally unfair.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
if I could just kind of wrap up. We recognize this would be a difficult issue for you, but two things. Number one, we also noted that this had been granted once before, although we're not sure how far it went, it sounds like, as to whether it ever was included in the final.
Okay, so you are talking about the same case.
I believe so. It's actually just based upon the
memo.
We'll do some
checking on it.
That would be great. And maybe the question is that we need to look at the law more broadly, understanding that there could be a significant cost to that. I understand that. But any consideration you'd be willing to give, we appreciate.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Just for clarification, Mr. Chair and Sergeant, if we do not pass numbers, you will still, when you retire, you will still get a monthly check from your Richfield Relief pension, will you not?
I will, at a rate about 50% of what my coworkers get for that same period of service. But yes,
what
yes.
You understood it was when you became a deferred
yes.
participant.
Okay, so Representative Osman moves that we set aside or do not incorporate. The XXX bill, it doesn't have a number yet, I guess. And we will do some checking on the, we believe it's the wellness situation.
Right.
Is that's the one you thought maybe had passed?
I believe so.
We'll
yes.
do some checking.
Thank
so the motion
you.
Is to not incorporate. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Bonoff, you started probably in the toughest place to start here.
Thank you.
Okay, you know, I have not seen errata.
Well,
so,
sir,
number four. Is Representative Anderson here?
Leski is here.
Well, she has sent me a note. She enjoys this discussion so much, she's going to let Representative Anderson go first.
Senator Koch here?
What?
Koch? The one who replaced errata? Is she here?
Oh. Oh, I'm really sorry. Senator Rod is no longer in the Senate.
That's why you don't see him. Right.
That's why I didn't see him.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Anderson, have you been sitting here like for hours or?
I'm sitting about 10 to 9.
Okay.
Or 10 to 8, I should say.
I apologize. Okay. Number four, Ed, Mr. Burick.
Members, this is a situation where a MRF member is requesting that he be allowed to have service credit for a period of disability that occurred many, many years ago. Now, MRF is one of the few plans that does allow service credit for a period of disability. The complicating issue here is that this period occurred decades ago, and the individual did not at that time apply for a MRF disability benefit. And MRF has no authority to grant disability or to give service credit for a disability period when the individual never applied for the benefit. The situation is fairly confusing. The individual was injured shortly after beginning in employment, apparently had a knee injury, worked for a few years, and then the individual apparently became disabled, was receiving some form of workers' compensation benefits. But for that period, and it lasted, it looks like 7.5 years, the individual never applied for a MRF disability benefit. Part of the confusion here is that there is some question as to whether the individual was even a MRF member during this period. The record seems to indicate that some contributions were taken from pay. There's some indication the individual had service credit in the records of the plan when that individual first started. But MRF has indicated that whenever a member is coming online, they send an application form to the individual, which the individual is to fill out and send back to the MRF Association. Apparently, that was never filled out and filed. It wasn't until 11 years after the individual first commenced employment with Minneapolis that the individual submitted that form. On the other hand, so while there's some question the individual wasn't really a member during this period, and one could certainly argue that it doesn't make any sense to provide any recognition for a disability for a period of time when the individual wasn't a member. On the other hand, there is an indication that the individual did have a little bit of service credit. And during this time, I believe in both 1980 and 1983, MRF did contact this individual suggesting that the individual ought to consider filing with the fund for a disability benefit. It would seem that that is not an action that the association would take if, in their view, the individual wasn't a member. So the commission may wish to sort out just what the individual status was during that period and also focus on whether it makes sense at this point in time to provide any recognition for that period in terms of service credit. Given that the individual does seem to have some personal responsibility here, given that the fund did at two points in time attempt to contact him and suggest that he apply for these benefits. So with those comments, I turn it back to the commission.
Okay. Mr. Mooney, anything to add to the?
Yes, if I could, I have a handout to everybody here. You can take a brief look at it.
Well, just someone will come and get it. Someone will come and get it. Mr. Mooney, my apology. I was sitting there watching for Senator Arata. And frankly, I didn't see you here, but I'm sure you were. So I do apologize. So,
well, when you said something about seniority, he jumped up. He said, "Well, I'm going up front."
So I apologize.
Yeah. Just want to hand them out. Basically, what I can kind of go through there. First of all, on some of the replies back on the back page, there's a statement there in retirement that we were handed out in 1973 when I started with the city of Minneapolis. and states there that all city employees participate in one of several retirement plans. Employees are hired,
thanks,
before July of 1978 belong to the following: either the police, the fire, or the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. In the next paragraph, it goes down. Participants in one of the city plans is mandatory for all the eligibility employers. So as I took placement for the city of Minneapolis in 1974, I applied. I thought everything that medical, I knew I had to be certified prior to me being certified. I wasn't eligible for any of those funds. Once I was certified, I thought, as far as I knew, I was a member of all the such things as far as my MRF plan. And there's also, right from the beginning, my all my checks were being paid into MRF once I was certified. So I was in the fund as far as stating that I wasn't a member of the fund even at any time. It doesn't correlate with what I understand it to be. I mean, I'm a construction worker, but I understand what I drafted up there, what I show you, is what I understand that to be, is that it's mandatory in that I was a member fund, and I am a member, at this time, for 33 years. And then if I may go on, as far as I had an accident in 1978, 250-pound piece of concrete smashed my leg. I had two surgeries. That is the reason why the injury occurred and why I was out. I was not able to return to work to my full line of duty as a cement finisher. So in contrast to that, I had a disability. And during that time, the MRF, I was not aware of the fact that I was eligible for a partial disability. And they state here that they sent me a letter in 1980. I was injured in 1978. On this first page, on this memo I gave you guys, it says that sometime in 79, which, that date just happens to be wrong. It really happened August 18, 1978. And it says in there that City of Minneapolis does not advise MRF of my injury. So there's 2 years of lacking before that I'm not even aware of that. They go on to say in 1980 they sent me a letter, and in 1983 that I would be eligible. My recollection, I never received any letter. And I'm like I say, I don't want to. The city of Minneapolis is my livelihood. They've been a good employer. I'm in a good status with the city of Minneapolis. I'm not here to put anything to make them out a bad individual other than a mistake or something properly as far as the a memo I was not ever given. And I just want to clarify the fact that 33 years I've been with the city of Minneapolis, and they've been a good employer to me. I respect them, and like I say, I hold a position with the city of Minneapolis in the paving department, and I have a responsible tech type of job. So, I mean, this is a problem I'm just bringing forth, trying to have some type of resolution and have it evaluated.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Judith Johnson, Executive Director of the MRF Fund. I believe the facts that are stated in the memo are correct. The 74-75 period actually was the back charges. In other words, there wasn't any money out of his check for the first 2 years after he was certified. So that's where the back charges come from. In 77, we called the city and learned he wasn't working, although they didn't advise MRF according to the log. And again, I can only respond based on our written records because I wasn't with MRF then. And it was in 1980 we learned that he was on workers' compensation. The city doesn't have a practice of notifying us of individuals going on workers' compensation. We catch it at the end of the year when we notice that they don't have wages typically, if we believe that they're being employed. Our records show that we send a regular letter, not by certified mail, or I think we would have indicated that in 80 and 83, and Mr. Our member indicates that he didn't receive those letters. In 85, we got an application in, but it wasn't notarized, so we sent that back, and then in 86, he did come in and file. Because of the way our law works, we have no power to grant him that credit. It says that MRF can only grant credit from the date that an individual files the application. I do have no doubt that, in fact, he was disabled during that time because he was drawing workers' compensation, as I understand it. Right. And so it is a question of equity for you to decide. I told Mr. Anderson, as you step back from it, but for the want of an application, he would have been awarded service credit for that time. In other words, clearly we would have awarded service credit, and it would have been paid for since there wasn't any wages at the time of retirement by the employer. And so how much responsibility do you assign to the member? How much do you assign to the city? These are things I don't know. We've never had one of these to have an opinion other than the fact that, as TRA says, we need the money to pay for the pension.
What is the amount in this instance?
It's approximately $80,000. The member hasn't had high wages at the city. Usually, MRF service is quite expensive. It's not as pricey as most, even though there's quite a few years, because the wages aren't all that high. And we would have the actuary calculate a formal cost right. if the bill goes right. forward.
Mr. Mooney, why didn't you return an application? It appears you had two opportunities in 80 and 83. Are you saying you didn't get
right,
notice?
Right, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like I say again, I mean,
that's a while back.
It's a while back. I mean, I just, you know, I can't believe that, you know, had I got a letter stating that I was eligible for X amount of dollars back in 1980, which would have been, I think, in one of the letters, it says $280 or something. In today's market, $1,200.
$280 a month?
Yes.
That's a monthly.
Right.
That's what they said. That, I mean, the letters that I did not receive, to my knowledge. I'm not saying they didn't send it or something. I just never received it. I didn't believe that I would not act on it. I didn't know that I was eligible for any pension, and I never received the letter, or I would have acted on it.
And Mr. Chair, I would point out a reason a person might not act on it, we've been told by a few people who were on, is that workers' comp takes that money out.
It's an offset on your workers' comp.
Right.
Dollar for dollar offset?
I'm not an expert on workers' comp. I just know that some people have elected to not draw their pension because they prefer not to have the offset.
Was there an option to not draw it, maintain
service?
No. For individuals who sign up for disability with us, then they draw it, and then there is an offset. We have some people on right now that we notify workers' comp. You can't sign up for work for credit and not get the pension. You're not any worse off.
You can't earn the service credit.
Right.
If what if?
I apologize
if I missed this. Others probably caught it. Are you still on?
Yes, I'm still working for the city of Minneapolis.
So you're back working for the city
right,
without
disability.
Right, I've
been disability. Back since 1990 or 91.
Right.
And like I said, I mean, I have a good rapport with the city of Minneapolis. I am still working. And
so in that sense, this is just a lapse in service credit time.
Right,
yes.
Right. I mean, I have 32 years in. You can retire with 29 years. And what I'm looking at is I wanted to get this reinstated. I don't my intent right now is to continue to work. I'm in a field where they want me to continue on to retrain in my field.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves that we have some staff has some further discussion with Ms. Johnson about what the possible remedies are here. So we do have this roughly $80,000 cost. We just need to understand our options before we move too quickly on this one.
Does that make sense? So I'm not moving that the city pay right now.
No.
No, you're not.
Mr. Chair, one thing you could consider is to simply allow the amount of service to get to retirement. I mean, I think one of our members' goals is to retire. And so instead of giving the full period of service, in fact, all our member needs is 29 years and 1 month. And he's requesting 32 years total, I think.
Right.
So one possibility to cut the cost down substantially, if you were persuaded to move forward on this bill, is to only provide him the service credit for what he would need to retire,
mm-hmm.
because I think that's the underlying goal.
Ms. Wagner, is the city open to any discussions on this, or is this a no way, never?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen Lowry Wagner, City of Minneapolis. I did look through some of this, and it appears it has been an ongoing situation. One of the things I do like to raise, would like to raise, is this does not, as proposed, contain the local approval clause
right.
that we have generally asked for all of our closed pension plans. So that would be something that I would also recommend. I think certainly we are open to sitting down. I do have to raise the problem of precedent again, like the previous situation, and I know it's noted in the staff memo as well.
This one seems pretty unique. What it seems an interesting policy. Why wouldn't the city automatically advise MRF as to someone being off on disability? I mean, it just seems, is
and
there...
I can't answer that, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know if that's something that no longer is happening or if it's, I think it's probably is happening now, but hasn't happened in the past, so it is something that has been corrected.
Well, Thiessen's motion is that we'd like some work by the city, MRF, on this and come back with some possible options for the commission to consider.
Yes.
Okay. On the Thiessen motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
We'll, hopefully we can help in some fashion, but thank you very much. Thank you for your years of service with the city. Okay, Representative Lencheski. And then we just have the Osment bill after that. Thank you, members, for your patience.
Who said you were patient?
Yeah.
What?
Who said
you're not patient, right?
Yeah, right.
Representative Lencheski, you've been patient.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commission members. I have about 200 letters to sign in my folder, so it's no problem to sit here. I'm introducing House File 2208. This bill.
Why don't we just have the staff tell us what's there?
And I should tell the staff and all of you as well that Mr. Savage is unable to be here, so he won't be able to respond
Mr.
to the questions.
Members, this is number 12 on your agenda, and this is a bill that would allow an individual who was a permit employee to purchase service credit for that. Period of time as a permit employee. There are a few issues that I would note for you. One is that I can't find the exact terms permit employee in MRF law, but it would appear that this is another name for temporary employee, and temporary employees were properly excluded from MRF coverage. So if a review by the commission indicates that this individual was properly excluded from MRF coverage, then the commission might want to think about whether to allow any service credit purchases at this point in time. Generally, the commission has not recommended passage of bills that would allow individuals to purchase service credit for a period of time that was properly excluded under law. The cost estimate that we're aware of is approximately $70,000. And a final issue is that, and I learned this after the memo was written, apparently this individual is no longer working for the city and would therefore appear to have already left the plan. Now, that could be viewed by the commission members as a factor which undercuts the need to consider this bill. Presumably, if this were a significant issue, something that the individual really needed to get resolved, they would get the issue resolved before leaving employment and before leaving plan coverage. So with those comments, I turn it back to the chair.
Anything to add?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think, and I wish he were, could be here, but he's not able to be here, my constituent. I do believe I introduced this bill the first time when he was still an employee with the city of Minneapolis. So at that time, the bill was, when it was first introduced, that wasn't the case as it is currently now. I would just add that I think this is presents a quandary for the commission members. I am aware there's a mixed record on the Pension Commission on these issues. I believe in the year 2000, two similarly situated folks were granted this ability to purchase the service credit and pay the actuarial cost. And then I think in 2003, Senator Lori had a bill and that person was denied. So I think the record is mixed, and I know there are many policy considerations for all of you to consider in what you would determine with Mr. Savage.
Ms. Johnson, $30,000. Other comments?
It's about
$70,000.
It would be 2 years of service. Just one thing I'd like to point out. This is the first case we've had where somebody's tried to buy permit service who's been involuntarily terminated from the city. And so the reason he would want to buy the service, and that's a lot of money, is that he could then retire immediately. The way the MRF rule works is with this service he'd have his 30 years and he could retire immediately, and I've shown the calculation of what his pension would be.
Oh,
or he would go on deferred status, get 3% augmentation, and could retire at 60. Because he's 50, I suspect he may be thinking through whether he should spend the money and draw an immediate benefit. But that's the purpose that I believe he's trying to buy the service for, because he can't get the service unless he goes to work for another public employer, and then he would qualify for combined service. And the fund never takes a position on these as long as somebody pays the cost.
Does Minneapolis have a position?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quickly reading through this one, I think we would again touch upon the local approval clause as it pertains to a specific city fund and a closed fund. And we really haven't had a chance to discuss this one, so maybe a motion similar to the prior one where we have a little more chance to sit down and discuss this would be appropriate.
What's the...
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator, Mr. Burke?
I was just going to comment that as this is drafted, the individual is required to pay the full actuarial value.
Right.
So that would lessen the need for a local approval clause.
Okay, Thiessen moves, no he doesn't, Murphy moves that we treat this as the previous bill, allow the city an opportunity to visit a little bit on this one with MRF, come back with some possible options or suggestions, or opinion that we shouldn't do anything, if that's the way everybody gets. So, does that work for you, Representative? Okay, on the Murphy motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much for your patience. Last bill then, 2523. Mr. Martin? Okay. Well, members, number two had been taken off the agenda previously, and today, number three, the authors called, and the affected employee was not able to be here, so we pulled number three also. Two will not come back. Three perhaps will be on the agenda again. Mr. Martin?
Members, this bill relates to nine custodians who are currently employed by the Bloomington School District. They had a period of employment with the Bloomington School District during which they were not reported to PERA for membership. The periods go from 3 months up to 3 years and 5 months of uncovered service credit. This permits the individuals to obtain service credit for that period and requires that they pay what contributions they would have paid at the time plus interest, and that the Bloomington School District would pay the balance. This is somewhat, this is a large number of employees all in one group. The practice dates back to the period 1985 to 1989, assuming that these individuals met the salary threshold applicable to PERA at the time, which was $325 per month or $425 per month, depending whether it was the start of the period or the end of the period, and assuming that these were actually regular permanent employees, it looks like employment time that should have been reported to PERA. The other issue is, how culpable do you want to hold the school district?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, we were contacted by Mr. Allers, the representative of these individuals, and given the dates of employment, and staff has included in our record what we have indicated was reported to us. There is definitely a gap. Had we been notified that there was a gap, we would have made the inquiry initially, but we didn't know there was a gap between the time they were hired and the time they were reported. The PERA board's position is that if you determine, or if it can be determined, that the service would have otherwise been eligible service to be covered by PERA, we don't oppose the actual purchase of the service, and who pays the cost is your decision. When I contacted the school district yesterday, the finance director was not aware of this issue. She didn't know if, in fact, the HR person was aware of it. So I did not hear back from them. I just put them on notice as to how the bill was written, and that suggested that they may want to get in touch with the commission. Bottom line is, we provided the numbers to staff. We calculated the actuarial value for each individual who has a gap in service, and we wait to get verification on whether or not the service that for which they weren't reported was eligible service for PERA.
So we know these are the gaps. We know that. It's now a question of whether it's eligible service.
Yes, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Allers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The school district, I'm personally aware of, was aware of this legislation, although I'm not sure that they were aware of this hearing today. Some exchange of emails with their previous human resources director who has left, so that may have...
Okay, because this bill was around last year or the year before, I believe.
Last year, yeah.
Last year, yes.
The other thing I would just point out is I believe of the employees that are listed in the bill, either one or two of them may have taken left employment and taken a refund. So that should be looked at.
If you can help the fund with that, that would be good. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. I represent the Bloomington School District. And
Your name is?
Kingsley Holman. I'm sure no one envies my position at this time. Let me tell you what happened. Late yesterday afternoon, I received a fax from the finance department saying I ought to appear at this hearing, and they didn't really know what it was for. And I tried to find someone who did. I got the hold of the superintendent, and he had no knowledge of the whole matter. And he said he'd get on it right away. In the meantime, I had to come to the hearing. So he did, and he called me back, and he said he's got somebody working on it and trying to get the facts. Apparently, there are some problems. We don't know if these were temporary employees at the time or whether they were not. What we do know is two of the applicants have been discharged since then, subject to grievance, and also this is a 16- or 17-year-old matter, and there's nothing but done on it for all this period of time. And to get suddenly hit with a large sum like they are suggesting really is going to have a strain on the budget. I have asked the superintendent if he would prepare some kind of a written statement that could be given to this commission. And I asked permission to have that given to you because I really don't know much about it except the fact that I do know that the laws of latches and statute limitations would apply normally in something like this, and they're long past due.
Well, we appreciate the fact that the district isn't quite ready yet. Why don't we obviously we're going to allow some time for the district to think through this, but I think this is a bill that was here last year, and there does appear to be something here that needs to be addressed. So if the district can kind of figure out if this was eligible employment or wasn't, then I think we can work through the issues of how to find a remedy that's fair.
Yes, and I'll be glad to have him send you the report. Okay.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I stayed for this one because this is my school district, and I want to thank Mr. Holman for being here, Mr. Allers. I just a point of clarification on this issue. I looked at the agenda last night and realized this was on the agenda for Representative Osmond and was puzzled as well, so we're all confused. Representative Larson and I have a bill on this that we put in last year as well that solved this problem in a different way. And so I was kind of puzzled as to why the Osmond bill was on, and then the other one from the Bloomington delegation was not. So I think we're all, and in no way inferring that you know anything about
that. If it's
there,
we'll find it.
So. I think what we're all learning in the room is there's been a miscommunication some way. So I would like to suggest that if SEIU and Mr. Holman and I, the superintendent, other Bloomington legislators with Representative Osmond could all kind of take a look at the facts in this case, try to get find a way to help this group of employees in our Bloomington schools. They're a very deserving group of employees, and maybe the commission could just delay some action until we get some more information, if that would be all right with Representative Osmond.
I think it is.
No objection.
Yeah, we can do that. We would like that, Mr. Holman, we would like, I recall specifically about a year ago, the district telling me personally they were going to get on this. You're not there, so it's not you at all I'm suggesting, but you just might mention that the chair of the commission remembers the district telling him that they were going to get on this a year ago. So let's just get on it and work on it.
As was mentioned, the personnel director took another job. And,
right. That may be the rationale. Is Mr. Press still the superintendent?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Prest, our superintendent, was just chosen as superintendent of the year. And, yes, he is still the superintendent, and I will talk to him personally in the next couple days. And
we have some time.
We'll see what we can figure out.
We would like to try to figure something out before session starts here. We're trying to get all the commission's work done before session.
So. That would be great.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Mr. Allers, thank you. Members, I think that's the agenda for today. Thursday, do we meet? Thursday, 9 to 11, hopefully, in here. And it's another list of individual bills like this. And is that going to fill the agenda, or do we need to add? I think that'll be what we do that day.
Are they like this or better?
What?
Are they bills like this, or are they bills that are better?
Tougher.
I didn't think this group was too bad.
Costs a lot of money.
We are encouraging the House to keep working on a couple of those other major issues.
No meeting needed.
Meeting adjourned.